Topic, the RF finder presentation. So, you know, it was 3 years ago. But, you know, I remember watching it. It was interesting. But too rich for blood, Roy. Back to you.
So it looks like he needs to pick up the phone. Nobody's he's not able, whoever is messing up with us, he's not able to switch the transmission.
Now, the problem, like I said before, as best I can understand, is that Barrie, Ontario, Canada, has a software program to link with us at around 8:30, and it's always on. This day today, I think it is broadcasting weather for no apparent reason. Now, our Selden repeater is the point where it links to IRLP. And it keeps timing out. So when the Selden IRLP node times out, we're left to ourselves.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Radio.
And now it's going to relink, and we're going to hear Canada again.
Link clear.
Yep. But it doesn't have a time to switch on. And it's not the weather report is 3 years old, as Paul said.
No, he said RF Finder was 3 years old, not the weather report.
Okay, so, coming back to this subject. So, we have a platform that is Zulu, that is American. We have a radio that differs from the regular transform with that based on what was said on ham version, has 5 to 10 watt transmitting at 2 meters and 70 centimeters. This is good. This is good. So the only question is, if a software is $60, the previous radio is $1,600, the radio at Harvation is $999, and on the Alibaba, which is comparable to Amazon, Alibaba, you can buy it for $168 with definitely some different software. And it says that you can put D star in it. You can put that and that and that and that. You can put, but it's not coming up with it. So it means it's a questionable support and questionable radio, Dr. Roy.
Okay, well, that's your standard operating Chinese radio. Chinese cell phones can go all over the place. Most of them are inferior to, obviously, to European and American. They tend to use old versions of Android or cloned, pirated, broken forms of Android or Android-like operating systems. Their chipsets tend to be kind of old because we have an embargo on the latest, greatest chips. So, you know, they came out with some ridiculous thing that cost something like $1,500 or $1,600. It's a tri-fold cell phone, and the tri-fold displays break almost immediately, and the thing overheats because they're using old architecture, but they're trying to run it at modern-day speeds. So caveat emptor up the wazoo with these things. They're interesting. I'll give you, they're interesting. When I saw it, they were interesting. Would I spend $1,500? No. Would I spend $1,000? No. Would I spend $500 for that? No. I don't particularly care for Android phones to begin with. So, you know, and, you know, you want to use a whole bunch of iOS Apple applications that interface to gateways? There are more than a few out there. Some people don't like to program for Apple, so they're only available for Android. There's something called Droid Star, which they beta tested on Apple, and then they let the beta expire, and they never released a final version, so they kind of said, screw Apple. You know, I got enough ways to communicate. I don't need a $1,500 interesting object.
Absolutely agree with that, Dr. Roy. It's a $60 software. If you want to do not spend one single penny, you install on your cell phone Echolink, and then you have contact with all over the world, whatever you want. Instead of spending even that $999 plus tax whatsoever, and then you do not have a standard of whatever they say you can put in it. So put in it. And to exchange.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio.
AC2GS. Let's see if we get the weather any moment now. Yeah, the problem is Echolink's wonderful, but Echolink will only give you Echolink notes. So any repeater or any individual who has an Echolink node, you can talk to. If they have an All-Star node, you can't. You need an All-Star device to get onto All-Star. You need a hotspot to get onto Brandmeister or all the other digital voice gateways. So, you know, radio has radio is kind of balkanized. So, you know, there's lots of channels, but they're not all connected to each other. And so you settle on some bunch of methods to communicate with people. You can't be on all of them because there's not enough hours in the day.
ZY2H.
Low, low. How I love hearing your voice. What can you do for us, Lou? Can you save us from Canadian weather?
Yeah, I think so. I just attempted to disable the ROP node, so we'll see.
Thank you. Thank you so very, very much, Lou. Peace on, in our time. Thanks to Lou. Wesley, you want to continue?
Yeah, another one is another subject. Carbon fiber is conductive. What is this sort of puzzle? So there was a report from one of the ham radio operators from Poland that he witnessed the guy who had a pole made of carbon fiber, and the guy was trying to put it on, but accidentally he touched the high power, high voltage power line, and he died. So then the question is, okay, before we go to that, DS Engineering has the number of telectroscopic carbon fiber masks starting from $599 for 27 feet, then $849 for 10 sections, which is, I'm not sure how top tall it is, then $469, $229, ending with $57 for portable one, which is sort of being carbon 6 compact ultra light telescopic mass, carbon 6, whatever. So, anybody wants to talk about it and explain what is conductive in carbon pole and what is not? Please.
Yeah. Carbon fiber is kind of a misnomer, because if you had something made out of purely nothing but carbon fiber, it would fall apart, because there's nothing inherently in carbon fiber to hold it together. What you're doing with what you call carbon fiber is you're embedding carbon fibers into a matrix of insulating epoxy. Without the epoxy, it would just kind of unwind and just fall to all the little teeny fibers that make it up. So it's a mixture of carbon fibers embedded in insulating epoxies. I guess if you destroy aspects of the coating and rip away the epoxy and offer it bare carbon, carbon is a semiconductor, much like silicon. It is not as good a conductor as copper or gold or silver. It's a kind of mediocre conductor, which is why carbon film resistors exist. It's the carbon film semiconductor that gives you a certain degree of resistance according to the dimensions of the carbon film. So carbon by itself is a semiconductor. It conducts, but not as well as most metals. Carbon fiber that's intact shouldn't really be conducting, because it should be fully encased in a resistant epoxy matrix.
I agree, absolutely. So, the dielectric constant, isolating constant, how would you call it if you try and get against the high voltage power line? Back to you.
Conductivity, resistance, breakthrough voltage, there's a bunch of ways of kind of describing things.
Right. So, keep in mind, N2XG, and keep in mind that it is not conductive because it's resin. Resin is not conductive, but conductivity, or if we compare it to isolator, I have no wording, Dr. Wright.
It's a matter of breakdown voltages. If you get the voltage potential big enough, electrons can jump across any kind of insulator. So, I mean, you know, if you take a carbon fiber rod and you wave it around the 100-volt potential, nothing much happens. You wave it around the 100,000-volt potential, probably something bad is going to happen.
Okay. So the next one is, can red-hot mirrors still reflect an image? But before we go to it, there is a simple question. How long does a mirror image reflect itself in two opposite mirrors? So let's say the average mirror might have a reflectivity of 90%, a really, really good mirror might give you 99%, that it means that any given photon, there is a 99% of the chance to survive, then bounce at the mirror to another mirror. And it continues to be a part of an image, but the 1% chance to be absorbed and scattered. So, the question is, how long does a mirror image reflect itself in two opposite mirrors? Maybe Dr. Rick would like to rephrase that question and to actually.
AC2GS. I don't know. I mean, what you said makes sense as far as the question. I mean, it's not one that anyone's going to be able to answer because it depends on a whole bunch of things. And very few high-precision mirrors are capable of 99% reflection. And usually those types of mirrors are limited to a very narrow bandwidth of frequencies. The usual silver-backed mirror that most of us are familiar with are more broad spectrum, but far less reflective. There's approximately 90% reflection. So, the question is, and no one's going to have an answer because the answer is not, 72.3 copies of something. But nevertheless, just to paraphrase, Wesley asks if anyone has any opinions of how many times an image could bounce back and forth between two highly reflective mirrors and continue to generate an image from that reflection back and forth and back and forth.
Okay, it looks like there is no response. Yeah, so whatever you may comment, it's like Dr. Ray.
Okay, like I said, depends upon the percent of reflection, depends upon the distance, depends upon the illumination, and depends upon the resolution that is your endpoint. At one point, does the perspective of the reflections going back and forth lead you to such a small image that it's unrecognizable anymore? If you ever take a look at any kind of demonstration of people who put a mirror next to another mirror and produce a lot of ever-growing smaller copies, sometimes you'll see people who have a feedback mechanism in their video stream, and so they're feeding their image to their... To the program that produces an image within an image within an image in the same effect. You usually see something like 50 or 60 copies before it becomes you're unable to kind of differentiate the little reproduction in the center of the image. So, there is no answer. It's more than 10 usually, but less than 1,000. So take it as you will.
émission pour l'aéroport régional de Lac-Chine par environnement Canada à 18h30, heure normale de le dimanche 15 décembre 2024. Soir, cette nuit et lundi, vent du sud-est à 25 nœuds, diminuant du sud-ouest à 15 du soir. L'intermittence se changeant en plus lundi après-midi. Mardi, vent d'ouest à 25 nœuds. Mercredi, vent d'ouest à 15 nœuds. Jeudi, vent du nord à 20 nœuds, diminuant à léger. Prévision pour Belle-Georgienne, par environnement, Canada à 18h30, heure normale de l'est, le dimanche 15 décembre 2024. Soir, cette nuit et lundi, vague 1,5 mètres, diminuant à 1 verre de minutes, augmentant à 1,5 verre de minutes. Vague plus haute que des orages. Émission pour la Guinée City à 21h, heure normale de l'est. Température 1 degré Celsius. Direction du vent et sud-est, vitesse du vent finie. Les conditions pour bouler la Cinco ne sont pas disponibles en ce moment.
Ah, les conditions
pour bouler Belle-Georgienne Sud à 21h. Heure normale, il est
temps.
Température 0 degré Celsius. Direction du vent sud-est, vitesse du vent 5 nœuds. Rafale devant lui, température de l'eau moins 20. Conditions pour l'aéroport de Boston, 21h, heure normale, il est
temps. Température 1 degré Celsius. I can hear you, I can hear Frenchie.
Vision pour Berlin, par environnement, Canada à 17h, heure normale, il est le dimanche 15 décembre 2024. Soir fini. Cotter, santé maximale de 2 pour 10. Lundi, Calter, santé maximale de
2
pour 10. Lundi, soir fini. Calter, santé maximale de 2 pour 10. Mardi, Calter, santé maximale de 2
pour 10. Yeah, I'm thinking about, because I think this is coming via another plan. I think somebody's spoofing us.
Well, that's certainly possible. I mean, as far as I can see, our note isn't there, but between the two mirrors. It depends upon the light intensity in the room. You know, in a dim room, you'll get less reflections than in a bright room. It depends upon a whole bunch of different things. It's not a number. You know, if you tell someone if you give someone the 99% efficiency reflectivity, no one is going to be able to tell you a specific number. They'll give you a very, 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 very wide range because there's too many other variables involved in this question of yours.
I'm only hearing this on the output of Selden. It sounds like Glenelson and Middle Island are being interrupted now with this weather.
Right now I don't hear the weather. When the weather I hear is coming out of the Glen Oaks repeater. Where it's coming from, I don't know. Again, I assume it has something to do with the IRLP, but according to what I'm looking at, our IRLP is down, or at least it's not being reported on my website. So it's going in from some other route, I guess.
Yeah, I was just hearing it on the Selden output, but I was not hearing it on Glen Oaks or Middle Island, so it's possible somebody was transmitting on the output frequency. I really don't know. I'm watching my indicators here, and they're telling me, no, it's not coming in from IRLP. So somebody may have connected their own IRLP and is transmitting directly on the output frequency in Selden. I'm not really sure, but all right, we'll keep trying to crack away here. Continue. NY2H, clear.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Lou. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be that they linked it through IRLP. They could have used Echolink. You could probably get to that repeater through Echolink. And, you know, you don't have to necessarily just tap it into our Echolink. You could just broadcast it. So, unfortunately, there's more than one way to skin a cat.
Friday, and Saturday with 60% chance of flooding.
ATT lockup begins.
Oh, well, back to you, Wesley.
Okay. Some speculation. Time reflection. I'm trying to be clever. But humoristically clever. Okay, time reflection, you still have a 90% of light, 100, you are down to 36%, and 1,000 reflection, you will be down to 4 times to 10 to minus 5, just 40 parts in a million of the original image, so the assumption would be that it is no longer visible. Okay, so in the mirrors, if the mirrors are 1 meter apart, then the 1,000 reflection occurs in 3 millionths of the second. If you calculate the speed of light. Now, if you're trying to be more advanced, I believe those limit formula, the R equal 11.6 divided by D, where R is the angle that can be resolved in arc seconds, and D is the diameter in centimeters. And then we will go to 2 million reflections. 2 million reflections with that. But as you said, nobody is able to guarantee that 9% of reflectivity by 2 million reflections, you will have that 2 times 10 to minus 8, 7, 3, 0, few Fulton. It's just the assumption. Back to you.
Yeah, that's a very big number. That's probably a bigger number than all the particles in the universe. So, you're getting these from a couple of guys chatting on Reddit and Quorum and other such places. You're not getting them from, guys writing PhD theses on the subject. And the equation that you use isn't really created for that calculation. I think it's primarily used for curved mirrors for enlarging or, you know, for telescopes or something like that. I forget the exact thing. But, yeah, I mean, you know, there's no answer. You know, I mean, these guys throw out a number that is so ridiculous that the entire universe's number of particles is a smaller number. So, you know, it's, I guess it's good for some kind of a riddle you tell in a bar, but otherwise, you know, it's not really going to tell anyone anything useful.
I actually would hope that somebody in the bar would talk about it, because it is something unique. It is something uncommon in the bar. Back to you.
Well, it would have to be a bar across the street from some physics department.
Okay. Yeah, actually, the last time I was in the bar was several years ago. I have no idea what people talk about it there. Anyhow, so the subject was, does a red hot mirror reflect light the same way? So we have a mirror when we're heating it. If the mirror is made out of glass and you heat it at one point, it's going to break. If you make a mirror out of the metal sheet, then it's not going to break. But the question remains open. Does the red hot mirror reflect light the same way? Anybody wants to respond to that? Okay, Dr. Ray.
The reason why metals act so great as reflectors is because on their surface they have a series of free electrons that are delocalized. That's what makes a lot of metals good conductors. And as everyone hopefully knows, as you heat up a conductor, it gets to be worse and worse. The free electrons don't flow easily. And so the same thing happens for mirrors. If you heat up a mirror, you're heating up the metal, you're heating up the free electrons, and you're degrading the capability of the surface of the metal to reflect as well as it does. So pretty much any metal, as you heat it up, its reflectivity goes down.
Yes, I agree with that. But there are a few caveats in it. So, in summary, a highly reflective surface will not glow at the same intensity as a less reflective surface, but it will still reflect the light. And if you heat the reflective surface to incandescence, let's say its emission is picking up. Well, let's take 600 nanometers. Will it reflect 600 nanometers light in the same way it did when it was cold? Back to you.
No, its reflectivity doesn't go to zero necessarily. It just goes down. So it is less reflective as you increase the temperature, and different metals have different curves of how temperature relates to their reflectivity. But they all go down. None of them go up. None of them stay straight. They all go down to one degree or another.
Okay, so do you say that this statement is right or is wrong? So if a good mirror reflecting nearly all light, a good mirror reflecting nearly all light, won't glow. Its emission absorption coefficient is close to zero, so, and it will still reflect the light as previously. Back to you.
Not quite sure what you're getting at, by the way, AC2GS. Mirrors are not great black bodies. You know, there's something called black body radiation, which is the perfect black body is totally non-reflective and only emits electromagnetic waves based on its temperature. So that's black body radiation. But we say that the sun has black body radiation, and it certainly is a is an object that you know interacts with the world. It's not probably a perfect black body, but it comes close. So mirrors are not perfect black bodies. They reflect, but they also emit. So if you increase the temperature of the mirror, according to black body radiation, it will emit a spectrum of electromagnetic waves in addition to reflecting light back out to a lesser extent as it increases in temperature because, as I said before, the mechanism of how metal atoms in a lattice reflect electromagnetic waves deteriorates as the temperature goes up. So the temperature goes up, the reflectivity goes somewhat down, and the black body emissions go up.
I say that there are a lot of mirrors working at the infrared room temperature, right?
Yes, a lot of them are running at room temperature. The amount of degradation isn't probably that bad, and certainly black body radiation is in the infrared zone, so we don't perceive it.
No, I was talking about deep infrared, Rich.
What about deep infrared?
There are a lot of mirrors that they work at deep infrared region.
Yes, depends on the material.
Okay, so a hot object usually emits infrared. So what about mirror that is being heated by infrared?
Not quite sure exactly what you're getting at once again. Depending upon the mirror, you could have a mirror that reflects the different electromagnetic wave spectrum, including the far infrared and the near infrared. It will partially absorb, again, because no mirror is 100% efficient, and it will produce heat, and it itself will produce kind of black body radiation, but, you know, in the infrared where you won't even recognize its existence. But, I mean, it's only, you know, if you make it out of the right stuff, the amount of heat absorption will be minuscule and will just be part of the background noise of the apparatus.
No, I was talking that infrared is associated with heat. But anyhow, optical properties of the material, well, in general, right, depends on the temperature and the reflectivity of metals, as far as I know, decrease with temperature when the temperature rises. So, considering multi-layer dielectric mirrors, the reflectivity may also change at high temperature. Due to optical thickness of layers, but also it may be due to the absorption of initially transparent layers. And actually, I recall something. Porcelain, your bathtub or your toilet bowl is made from porcelain, and porcelain is supposed to act as a mirror. So why is not reflecting that much? Back to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, as far as I know, if a porcelain is properly glazed, it has a smooth surface on it, so it has a degree of specular reflections, and you can kind of see things. If it's a flat piece of porcelain with a good glaze, you can see a percentage of the reflection. It's not anywhere near 90%, but it exists, and as long as it has a smooth finish. If it has a rough finish, then it has a more specular type of scatter light coming off at odd angles and isn't a proper mirror. But if it's perfectly smooth, there's a certain degree of reflection that goes on the surface of porcelain.
My impression is different. Porcelain is slightly transparent. So the light will go deeper and become a trap in the medium. And the amount of light that is reflected is not directly from the surface, but from deeper part of the porcelain that actually tries to reflect that light. Back to you.
It depends on the glaze. If it's not glazed, then yes. And that's also from the video. I recognize that comment. It's not fully reflective. It goes through and reflects off granules of the porcelain crystals in its matrix. I was just alluding to highly glazed ones, which is basically like glass. If you have a pane of glass, even though light goes through glass because it has a different refractive index, it reflects off the surface because of the differing refractive index.
So the equation may look like reflection by plus transmission plus absorption equal 1 equal reflection plus emission for the perfectly opaque material and absorption, and that equals the emission. That's how I understand that. Back to you.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this before. Electromagnetic waves have a bunch of ways of responding to media. They can reflect, they can refract, they could absorb, they could scatter, and I'm probably leaving out one or two. But there are different ways that light can interact with objects, particles and surfaces and other such.
Okay, so the next subject is throwing minus 346 snowball made of solid nitrogen. I'm going to need help of Paul because we're going to be talking about the space. So the guy in the video was trying to throw the ball made of solid nitrogen and nothing happened. Even Dr. Roy mentioned that this may not be an interesting subject. But then, if we're talking about nitrogen, chemical makeup of atmosphere is made, well, if we exclude the water vapor, then we have a nitrogen, oxygen, argon, carbon dioxide, neon, helium, methane, krypton, hydrogen, nitrous oxide, carbon monoxide, xenon, ozone, nitrogen dioxide, iodine, and ammonia. And nitrogen is 78.84%, so 78% is nitrogen in the air. And then if we look at the nitrogen, the critical point, the supercritical state on it, when it's liquid, let me drop. I have nitrogen plant. So it's made from nitrogen, from dry air generator, then I have a nitrogen generator, then in gaseous state, then it goes to the liquid nitrogen generator, which actually cools it down. I remember minus 198 degrees of Celsius. I don't remember how much it is in Fahrenheit, but the pressure is important. The guy in the video actually made the liquid nitrogen. He didn't make the liquid. He poured the liquid nitrogen and he changed the pressure on it. And it creates frozen nitrogen. But the nitrogen cannot stay frozen. Do you agree with that, Dr. Roy?
Well, if you keep the temperature and the pressure correct, it can stay frozen for as long as you can do that. It's not a matter of time. It's a matter of environmental factors. You know, there's a phase change chart that has the temperature and pressure. And depending upon what the temperature and what the pressure is, it's either a gas or a liquid or a solid. And time is not a factor in that graph.
I'm trying to find a counter argument to what you're saying. The liquid nitrogen cannot be stored. It has to evaporate, right?
Presently, modern technology, Earth, yes. If you're not on Earth, if you're on a place that's below the boiling point of nitrogen, no, you could leave it out if you're in that environment.
So you have two factors. You have a factor of the temperature. You have a factor of the pressure. And you have a factor of time. If in given pressure, the liquid nitrogen changes to solid, the change by itself is the energy equation modification, and by that it is solid, but it tries to come back to the gaseous one. Isn't that true?
No. Look at any phase change table. There's pressure on one side, there's temperature on the other, there's no T, there's no time in a phase change diagram.
I might say you are really good, Dr. Roy. I was trying to get you on something. I'm sorry. Okay, so we're talking about a triton. So on the video, the guy threw the solid nitrogen and was trying to see if that the solid nitrogen is gonna break something. It was electrocuted the face or of the mask. But anyhow, we're not talking about that. Voyager 2 revealed details about Triton. And the reason we're talking about the Triton because it has a lot to do with solid nitrogen. So we have the largest moons in our solar system. Ganymede, Titan, Callisto, Luna, Europe, Triton, Titania, and Rhea. I was trying to find out how big is the Triton. But actually, it's not the biggest one. Ganymede is the Jupiter largest moon, and it's really, really big. Then we have Mercury, the dwarf Pluto, and only slightly smaller. That is only slightly smaller than Mars, and people want to go to Mars. So, Triton, the moon of the moon of Neptune, right, was discovered in 1846, just 70 days after the Berlin Observatory discovered the Neptune. Scientists the using telescope, whatever. But anyhow, that was the mission of Voyager 1 that actually allowed that to be discovered. Let me drop.
Correction.
Okay. Now, would Paul tell us more about it? Paul.
Yeah, that's Voyager 2 that went past Neptune, and Voyager 1, you know, got as far as Saturn, and they wanted to see what was under the clouds of Titan, and that by changing that trajectory, Voyager 1 was never able to come back, go into that arc to go to the other planets. But they kept Voyager 2, and that was what was good about having two craft. That one was able to go visit the outer planets from Uranus and Neptune. But the diameter of Neptune, I think it's roughly four times the diameter of Earth, and then it has the moon Triton. The only weird thing about Triton, it goes in a retrograde orbit. They think it might have been, from the Kuiper belt and got caught up from the gravitational pull of Neptune. But that's very cold. When they took pictures of it with Voyager 2, they could see these black lines on it looked like black lines on the surface. And what that was nitrogen jets coming out of the surface, like little geysers. They would go like miles high, and then they would settle on the surface. It actually left these dark marks, and then that was a big discovery by Voyager 2. I remember that way back when. Anyway, I don't know what else you want. As far as the temperature change of nitrogen, we used to have these big bottles and thousands of pounds of pressure. So they were that was liquid nitrogen. Let me drop it. And we would test our piping system with it, so you'd have a gauge set up, and then you would put a line connected to the piping, and you would open up these valves, and depending on the humidity, the outside of these valves would really frost up, not with nitrogen, but it would frost up with the humidity in the air. This was the second you release that pressure, that's what would happen. Yes, Roy, and I used to carry pressure temperature relation chart. They call them PT charts in my wallet, for a lot of the different common chemicals that we would deal with, including, believe it or not, water and the ammonia chart and things like that. But yeah, if you drop the pressure on that, that's what's going to happen. It's going to take energy from itself and actually become even colder, maybe even freeze west. The same thing happens on the moon Triton. Pressure will get, once it goes up in the air, that it refreezes and comes right back down. I guess back to you, WS plan.
The reason I started the topic was because we were talking previously about reflections and temperature and pressure. So Triton's icy surface reflects so much of little light, sunlight reaches it, that the moon is one of the coldest objects in the solar system, about minus 400 degrees of Fahrenheit, which translates to minus 240 degrees of Celsius. And it is the only large moon in the solar system that circles its planet in opposite direction. So my question to you is, let me go to that material. What are some of the theories? why Triton that goes around the Neptune does it in opposite direction as other normal orbit moves around all planets or other planets. Back to you.
Well, it's never been confirmed, but it's believed that it came from the Kuiper belt. You know, that's beyond Pluto. And as it started to come in toward the, you know, the sun is actually pulling these things little by little. And it left the Kuiper belt, or might have hit another Kuiper belt object, and, you know, one goes one way, the other one goes the other way. Anyway, it starts heading toward the inner part of the solar system. And when it got near Neptune took, you know, the gravitational pull picked up on it, and it's possible to pull it into an orbit that's, you know, opposite, you know, all the other orbits. And if you look down from the north on the galactic plane, if you're looking down at the solar system, you know, everything's going counterclockwise around the sun from the north. Your planets are going around the sun counterclockwise. Your moons are going counterclockwise. But Triton numbers is going the other way. And depending on how, you know, how the gravitational pull pulled on it, it's possible that could have happened. That's why, by the way, that thing's in a very high elliptical orbit. You know, it comes close to the planet and then goes real far away from the planet. So that's what's happening with that. And I think you're talking about the albedo, the reflective surface. Yeah, and it's highly reflective. And therefore, you know, if it was dark, it would be absorbing more sunlight, more heat, but it's actually reflecting the light away. It's like having a white roof, you know? You have a white roof. That's pretty good in the summertime. It's going to reflect the heat away. But in the wintertime, you'd like to have a dark roof and keep your attic warmer. Anyway, over to you, West. WS2N.
So actually, you're not Voyager 2. You wouldn't know about moons of the Neptune, right?
I missed what you said on that one. Go ahead, West.
I was talking about that if not Voyager 2, because there is a very little light, you wouldn't even know about the moons of the Neptune, right?
Well, Voyager 2 did discover some of the moons. I think they're up to, I have an old chart here, but Neptune's... yeah, they had, what do I have here? Yeah, well, this is an older chart, 13. I think they're up more than that. We've discovered them, more moons with our ground-based telescopes. They've improved over the years. So my guess, they're probably up to 18 or so. But, Voyager did make some discoveries. Also spotted some possible rings around that planet. So you can't really see that from Earth. Back to you.
Okay, so the understanding is that the capture events are quite rare. And if you have two passing objects often going at quite different velocities, this means that the smaller object, the Triton, would severely beat towards the larger object Neptune, but will not go into the orbit. So the smaller object must lose some momentum to be captured. And if I remember, there was the evidence of the capture of that elliptic orbit, and that actually made the scientists think about the possibility that Tritant was captured, captured by a couple of belt Kuiper